Well, hello. How are you? It's nice to be with you today. I'm Jean Lawler. I'm your host for the Roads to Resolution Closure Certainty podcast and YouTube video. So anyway, it's great to be here today. A couple of weeks ago, I had started a little mini series for the month here on insurance, in particular insurance for people who don't regularly practice insurance coverage, and for how it then can play out in mediation. So today, the third episode of this little mini series is going to be on a topic that can get very complicated, but I'll try and keep it simple. It's risk transfer. In other words, who pays? When you are faced with a lawsuit and there are multiple defendants and some may owe other defendants or a defendant contractual indemnity or have named, you know, a co-defendant as an additional insured on their policy, their insurance policy, then, you know, how does this all play out? And what if they don't go ahead and honor that obligation? So it's very interesting, and how it plays out is very important. So the first thing that we're going to do and look at here is how the two ways work to transfer risk. And what we're talking about is essentially contractual risk transfer. And so that would be in a contract situation where, let's say, party B has agreed to indemnify party A if something happens. And by indemnify, I mean provide it with a defense and then pay whatever the settlement might be or judgment might be if it's a liability for which B has agreed to protect A against. And then the other way is through additional insured status of party A on party B's insurance policy, generally a general liability insurance policy, which is commonly referred to as a CGL. So here, I made some little graphs, and today, instead of holding up a piece of paper, I'm posting it here so you can see this. Party A, in other words, the one who is going to be indemnified, generally, for sake of examples, will be someone like a general contractor, a building owner, or the lessor of a building, could be, you know, the developer along with the general contractor. It could be any business who hires vendors or uses vendors or has other business relationships for providing services or products, perhaps. And then municipalities. They may be able to claim or be entitled to indemnity or protection from others. And the others, which I'm calling parties B, are entities and people such as subcontractors who would have entered into a contract with the general contractor or the developer, perhaps a tenant who owes an obligation to a building owner or the lessor if it's a subtenant, vendors if they're dealing with a business or providing services, and then ultimately building owners and lessors and tenants may well have an obligation, an indemnity obligation to a municipality, maybe the city or the county, if someone slips and falls on the sidewalk in front of a bank, maybe, and the bank needs to protect the city from those kinds of claims. They're supposed to keep their sidewalk clear. So that, in a nutshell, is what risk transfer involves. Again, providing indemnity protection, and then perhaps also providing additional insured status. You can have one without the other, but the way that they interplay with each other is very important. So that said, let's go back and let's talk about then, knowing that, how does it all work? Well, it works in a way that is like a puzzle, I suppose you could say. And so figuring out the puzzle before you go into mediation or while you're in litigation is really the key. So here's my little drawing on that. Let's say you've got a claimant. Okay, so we could use the slip and fall, for example, that I had started talking about before. So somebody slips and falls and they sue the property owner, the building owner, who is party A. Now, the building owner rents that property to a bank, and so the bank is party B. So the property owner turns to the bank and says, hey, I didn't do anything wrong, and you're supposed to take care of me and protect me in the event that there are any claims that, you know, fall within the scope of our contract, our indemnity provision in the contract. So A turns it over to B. Now, there are those two ways I mentioned before, either indemnity under the contract, or perhaps B here, the bank, has named the owner of the property as an additional insured on the bank's insurance policy, its general liability insurance policy. And those are the two ways. It's kind of like a part of a triangle, the two arms of the triangle, if you're picturing this and listening to the podcast. So let's go to the contractual side, the indemnity side for a moment. Under that side, B, the bank, owes A, the property owner, a defense to the lawsuit and owes the obligation to pay the claimant on behalf of the property owner. So either B pays or B's insurer, the bank's insurer, would pay on behalf of the bank and ultimately on behalf of A, the property owner. And so when B's insurer pays, and I say B is like party A and party B. So when the bank, in this case, party B, the bank's insurer pays, if it's just pursuant to the indemnity obligation, then that payment is all within the bank's policy limits. So if it had a $1 million liability policy and $100,000 was the settlement amount, and the bank had to pay for the property owner's attorney, if they had separate attorneys, and maybe that's $10,000. That's $110,000 that would be paid out as the bank's indemnity obligation to A, the property owner, to then, you know, it really gets paid directly to the claimant, I suppose, except for the attorney fees. But in any event, that all is within the policy limits, so that $1 million in policy limits is now worth, let's see, $110,000 less, so $890,000 if for the next claim that might come along that would fall under that policy. On the other hand, if the bank had procured additional insured status for party A, here the property owner, again, under the bank's policy, then the property owner, party A, would be an additional insured under the bank's CGL policy. That insurer would have defended party A, and that could possibly have been with the same attorney defending party B, as long as there was no conflict between the two of them, or a separate attorney if necessary. And that insurer then would also pay on behalf of both A and B to get the case settled. And so in that case, the attorney fees would be outside of limits and they would not reduce the limits because the duty to defend is included there. And then the indemnity, that $100,000 settlement, would be reducing the limits. So now the limits would be $900,000 that would remain. So it's definitely better for party B, whoever is agreeing to indemnify another person or entity, to have that entity or person be named as an additional insured. It protects their available liability limits and just makes it cleaner. If for some reason there was no indemnity, you know, the bank here in this example refused to indemnify, or its insurer refused to pay, then that would leave A, the property owner's own carrier, defending and indemnifying the property owner, and then probably looking back against the bank for subrogation or the other insurer for indemnity or contribution in a coverage action of some sort. So there you have it in a nutshell. That is risk transfer. And if you do have any questions about it, which it could go on and on for, you know, a whole whole half day session on this, please feel free to reach out. It's great to see you here today. Thanks so much for joining, and I'll see you again. Bye-bye.